Station number 13123, Cyril Mount.
Drill 9. We were talking about daily routine in life while you're in the Ruisa Ridge position. And we're talking about messing up at the OP. Any other things, particular meals? What would you do with bully, for instance?
Well, we'd make fritters out of bully beef. We'd sometimes make a hash. Sometimes we've got these tinned potatoes, so we mash the potatoes up into the corned beef. And pepper. So yeah, we got pepper and salt. We'd have, and you'd season it and make a sort of hash, and again put it in the oven so it all like crispy on top.
Would you curry anything after your? I mean, you've been in India.
Didn't have any curry, sadly. No, I would have loved to have had curry. I don't know. I don't think the Egyptians are into curry at all. No, we couldn't get anything like that.
And what would the routine be like up at the OP?
Well. There was the Arwad OP, which is at the base of the hill, and it's this little, what do you call it, a re-entrant, is it, in a hillside. Then, and the Arwad OP was there, and then there was this little path that had been sort of partly picked out, which led up to the OP itself. The OP itself had been blasted out of the hillside, out of the rock, and that was a sort of sandbagged and corrugated iron roof with sandbags on. And rocks. It wasn't very well camouflaged, it was obvious, and we could see the German OP equally clearly as they could see us on point 63.
And what was the routine then during
and the routine was to run a line up. Well, there would be a direct telephone line to the battery, to the troop, rather, from the OP. But if that was cut, as it was frequently, we had a remote control line so that the big set, the 19 set, stayed in the vehicle. And so it would need one of us on the vehicle, and then the officer would have his remote control unit in the OP, and you'd have to sort of put him through continuously. Because I'm trying to remember the system now, but that it was... Yeah, when you switch to send, you press the pressle switch, I remember. And I can't remember whether he had to tell you to sort of send because the remote control thing didn't do that. And he would give fire orders from there with his...
So he'd be up in the little blasted out one up there?
Yes, he'd be in the hole.
Would there be anyone with him?
And he'd have an OPAC, an OP assistant with him.
But the signallers would be down...
But the wireless operator would be down below, yeah. And... I would have somebody else with me as well, which would be an assistant wireless operator. And perhaps he'd be a linesman as well. But we had an 18 set, which is a mobile walkie-talkie thing, which strapped on your back like a pack. And we used that sometimes if we went forward with the infantry, usually at night. And you that was a bit scary because we had the Gurkhas.
That was while it was Ruisa Ridge you'd go.
Yes, we had the Gurkhas on our right, and they were. You could see them all down below us in sangars. A sangar is a built-up thing with stones. They weren't able to dig it very deeply, but they built these little sangars of stones. So these sangars were dotted all over the place, and you'd see the Gurkhas lying there, sometimes two of them together playing cards or whatever. You know. But at night, they would go out on patrol with socks over their boots or gym shoes on. And we would have to go with them sometimes.
What, do you remember any particular incident or time when you
No, it was mainly for information. They were very, very good at creeping up on people. How was it? Oh, it doesn't matter. It was a story I heard, but... we'd go with them, yeah, and they were mainly... the. Object of the patrol was not a fighting patrol, thank God. You know, in every case, it was really trying to find out where the enemy defences were, the FDLs, the forward defence lines, as they call them. And sometimes they'd send a Veery light up, and then you just sort of hit the deck very hard because. And sometimes they would get scary and just put a burst of breeder or whatever machine gun fire across. But luckily, I was never at any point sort of caught or hurt in that game.
And so that would you'd be up there? How long would you be up there?
And you'd be up there for 24 hours, And usually the officer in charge, the officer's got, they're able to buy quite a, almost seems to be an unlimited amount of whiskey. Canadian Club whiskey, it was a rye whiskey, which is quite nice, and gin. And so they would very often share their stuff with us, unofficially, because the other ranks were not supposed to have spirits. Sometimes we got beer, horrible watery American beer came up. But
Did the Naffy ever get up? I mean, a Naffy van?
I was going to say that occasionally you got a mobile Naffy, but things were severely rationed. You could have one tin of peaches or one tin of pineapples, one bar of chocolate or whatever, you know. You also got decent cigarettes. We were still getting these Victory V cigarettes with weevils in from India. And I've pictured one of those packets in that painting. I don't know if you noticed. I tried to put a lot of things in that painting that we had at that time. But you got a ration of cigarettes, which were 50 cigarettes in a, they were sort of Will's Navy cutters. But they were sealed, and on the lid there was a little point, which you slid along, and then you pressed it, and you turned it, and it opened this foil on the lid. And the smell of real tobacco was so beautiful. And you tried to make those 50 last, you know, because the other things are so awful.
Did you get parcels from anywhere?
A lot of people got parcels from home, but they were mainly sort of newspapers and things. I mean, people at home didn't have much to send, really. Comforts parcel. You got sort of things like gloves and scarves and cap comforters, balaclava helmets and things like that, which we came in parcels, obviously intended for Norway, and we got them in the Middle East.
What about, did you have any problem with lice or anything like that during the period?
Not at that period, but when we went forward and we were occupying some Italian positions. We weren't occupying. I'll come to that later, though.
You're right.
People did
during
get
that period.
Lousy,
What about sandfly fever or things like that? Any trouble?
No. There's no. I'll correct that. Yes, I think people did go back. With a lot of people had malaria. I went back myself. I was wounded later on, but I'll come to that in a minute. And I got malaria, a relapse of malaria, and other people did go back with relapses of malaria. And I think new sandfly fever, that's true, yes, there were cases.
What about desert sores? You mentioned that
everybody had desert sores.
I mean, what were they? I mean,
well, if you nicked yourself on anything, and there's a hell of a lot of sharp edges, and an armor, those Indian armored cars are full of little razor sharp corners. But apart from that, you had the tins, these petrol tins, which you were continually sort of opening and stabbing. So you'd open with a bayonet, really, but you still catch yourself. And wherever you nicked yourself, you immediately got, you know, what seemed like every fly in Egypt trying to get onto that sore, onto that bit of dried blood. And no matter what you did, you couldn't get rid of them. And they would probe. You could see that little tongues would be probing right inside that little wound, and eventually they would become septic, and people going around with their faces bright violet because of this. I don't know what it was, but there was the MO would paint stuff on their faces and hands, but that didn't keep the flies away. That disinfected. I think it was permanganate of potash or something, but it was a very bright violet stuff, and it to some extent stopped the infection from spreading, but you still had the flies coming on it. It didn't stop flies. There's nothing to stop flies except wearing gloves. If you were doing a job where you had to use your hands, you put these old gloves on with fingers cut off. And some people had this thing so bad they had bandages on their hands. There's so many cuts and sores. There were no skin diseases as such, nothing like impetigo or anything like that. But there was the usual prickly heat type thing.
You mentioned,
yeah. Yeah. And slippery, sort of like a saddle sore between your legs. Yeah, that I found very unpleasant. And a lot of people had a type of dysentery, but it wasn't really dysentery. It was just with straining. You know, very often you were constipated, and people were passing blood. But that wasn't sufficient cause to go sick. You know, you just put up with that.
So that you were in, now life was like that for quite a while. You were there from.
We were there right from June right through to November, which is when I caught it.
Now, what do you remember about the lead up to Alamein?
Well, the first thing we got were a whole pile of pamphlets, leaflets were being dished out. We knew that Montgomery had taken over from Auchinleck. We were very sceptical, because I think most people were fond of Auchinleck. We were very sceptical of this guy who'd come out and he was going to break eggs with a big stick sort of thing. But he kept sending these pamphlets, which were sort of semi-religious, you know, with God's help, and we will hit him for six out of North Africa, and that type of stuff, which people, you know, very ostentatiously used as bog paper. But I don't know whether that did have any effect on morale or not. But that was coupled with the new regime of physical training and leaping about in the sand and becoming fit. So we knew something was going to happen. This was even, you know, in September even. And eventually I think we got it first on the radio and the wireless that when the attack was going to be, the 23rd of October. Mm-hmm. It was going to start at 9:30 p.m. And we were all geared up for it. And that very night, I was on OP, I was at Frank OP with this Jimmy Haggard, who was a captain, Jimmy Haggard, he was an OP officer. And we sat there, it all opened up at 9:30. It was a hell of a night, it was quite incredible. And it seemed like all hell had broken loose. You know, you can't describe it. It was like millions of wild swans going overhead, and mixed with the sort of noise you sometimes get when a tram car goes around a bend, or tube train, you know, screeching. And that would be one that would be probably turning over, and you sort of think, God, is it going to hit us? It seemed to be about 6 inches above our heads all night long, this barrage.
Was your battery firing as part of it?
We're all part of it, but there were something like close to 1,000 guns firing all night, you know, and it was passing.
They'd be firing on a barrage, a prepared program.
It was a counter battery barrage to begin with, to an attempt to silence their 88s, which we knew we had their positions roughly.
So you wouldn't be, the OP wouldn't be involved.
We weren't involved. It's just we were just there. I don't know. Well, I suppose if there'd been a counterattack, I mean, it's, at times it was as light as daylight. There were so many flares going up. So if there'd been a counterattack, then we would have called for individual fire on that. But we just got very, very pissed that night on this Canadian Club whiskey. That's what I remember. And yet not so pissed that we were incapable. You know what I mean? It was adrenaline mixed with the alcohol somehow. It was an incredible night. The next morning, it gradually got light, and because the dawn came up behind us. The whole of the horizon, there was little flames here and there and smoke curling up, and it seemed like nothing could have survived all that. And that drawing's in the showcase down there. I did that in the back of a message pad. I didn't have my art stuff with me that night, and I did a drawing in the back of a message form, which is in the showcase down there at the moment, of all this smoke.
And you did it then?
But I did that there and then, that morning, yes, with a big hangover. And it was an incredible experience to have been there, you know, that was the big night. And we thought, well, it's a walkover now, gosh, you know. But it wasn't, because we were there until, well, I wasn't there. I came away on bonfire night. I got a splinter in my shoulder,
Had anything much happened before then? I mean, because they hadn't started to move forward.
The LPs, there was a, no, nobody's moving forward. The next barrage was a creeping barrage for the infantry to move forward and behind the tanks. But I don't think they got very far forward. I haven't really read my history about what did happen. It was all happening on the north of us. We were in the middle sector. But we got quite a lot of... I mean, all this gentleman's agreement about not hitting each other's OPs went, and we got shelled frequently in the OP. And the second time, about two or three days later, we got shelled. And then the next time I was up the OP was the 5th of November, and I was hurtling down the hill to the armoured car because there's something wrong with the set. The remote control wasn't getting through. And I was just climbing over into the armoured car, and I got a splinter in my left shoulder.
A shell splinter?
Yeah. And it felt like somebody just thumped me, you know, like that. And I sort of felt, oh, my shit, was blood running down my arm. So what happened then? The linesman came up in a jeep to fix the line. And I went back in that jeep to the, what do you call it, forward aid post, I think, or MDS. And they fixed me up. I think they dug it out, and I got a field dressing on it. And this was well behind the wagon lines. It was a sort of, it was a very small tented area, but it wasn't very posh at all. You know, there were just a hell of a lot of people who were badly wounded, lying around the stretchers.
How were you feeling?
I was disappointed because I got all hyped up, and I thought, you know, we're going to win this time, sort of thing, and now I'm out of the game, sort of thing, for a while. But and I couldn't lose my arm. My arm was sort of swollen up. And anyway, I went back in the field ambulance, and they put me out with... I don't know, it was pentothal or just ordinary morphine or what. And I went back in this very bumpy ambulance to, I think it was Wadi Natroon, was the name of the place. I know that keeps sticking in my mind. And there were tents, big EPIP tents, and English nurses. And it was quite nice to be fussed about a bit. But then I got malaria.
That's when you had the relapse.
I had a relapse, yeah. And so I had this hole in my shoulder and malaria. And the next time I woke up, believe it or not, I was in Nazareth, in a beautiful hospital in Palestine, in Nazareth, in the actual place where Jesus was born, yeah. Yeah.
You'd been out for quite a while, presumably.
Yeah, well, I'd been sort of delirious from this. You know, I was really... I was aware of being moved. I was aware of a train and being carted around on stretchers. But I woke up in this lovely bed, white, crispy linen, and it was lovely food, and the Jewish and English nurses. And down in the basement of this hospital was supposed to be the stable, the manger. You know, it was the hospital had been built over supposedly the place where Christ was born. And every quarter of an hour they played the most beautiful chimes on this sort of, what do they call it? You know, the bell, the bells of the campanile. You know, would play these lovely. I remember that very clearly. Very nice experience, really. Came out of there, went to...
How long were you there for?
I suppose about a week to 10 days, something like that. And I was sent to a convalescent camp.
Where was that?
In... What was it called? Was it Nathania? Something like Nathania. No, wait a minute, it was near Mount Carmel. I think it was probably near Haifa somewhere. But anyway, I went out the first night. It was a very, very nice... sort of camp, but there were still restrictions. We went out, and we went up this Mount Carmel, and found lots of very nice little cafes. It was like a fairy tale land after the desert. And we just did a pub crawl in these Jewish cafes, drinking Mount Carmel port. We were so thrilled by this. The guy I was with knew about port, and he said, they make some of the finest port in the world in Mount Carmel. So we drank this port, and we were in a cabaret at one time, where there was a Hungarian sort of belly dancer, and it was a really good night out, but we got very, very drunk and woke up in the the main street in Haifa. It was Haifa, and there's a dual carriageway with gardens in the middle, and we were lying on these beautiful lawns with a sprinkler system going over us like this, and lying on our backs. We'd lost our hats, we were totally in a disgusting state, and we both had a great big purple pool on our chest where we gently sort of all night long with this port. And God, oh Christ, we sort of got up with the most awful, awful headache, you know. I've never touched port since. And sort of got our way back to the camp, to the convalescent camp, got severely bollocked, and was then sent on. But the next day we were sent on. So, you know, you don't need convalescence if you're going to behave like this. And I found myself in the transit camp on the banks of the Nile. And for about...
Is this still before Christmas?
Pardon?
It
was getting on. It was November, late November. Yes, it was well into November when I was... And I was in this transit camp on the banks of the Nile. It was a marvellous little place, very small. And they asked if anybody could cook, and I volunteered to cook. So I was cooking there for about 3 weeks and really enjoying it because there's so many lovely rations. You know, there's eggs and there's dates and there's mangoes and fruit and all sorts of things. And each day a vehicle would come and from different units and call out. And apparently they'd ask for me back, and one day the three-tonner came along and my name was called and I went.
How did you feel? Did you want to get...
I was enjoying that, but I wanted to get back with the lads. I thought, well, no, this is skiving, you know, this is not on. You know, my mate's being killed, and no, I had to be back with them.
So you went back.
I went back, and by that time, they'd broken through. I've got to get this in, because apparently, you know, 4th Indian and 7th Armoured are the two famous divisions in the 8th Army. And apparently, I heard this from several sources, Montgomery is very racist. And he, although it would have been you know, a real honour for the 4th Indian to have gone forward with the 7th Armoured, to have been in the desert longer than anybody else, the 51st Highland and the 50 Dave and all those people went forward, and 4th Indian were left behind to clear up the battlefield. Well, I missed most of that. Missed all of it, in fact. But I heard horrendous stories from the lads, you know, about the coming across the gun pits. And literally bits of flesh rotting around, you know, that people were just blown to bits. And they had this job of, you know, doing what the Pioneer Corps were already doing, and other people. But they were doing burial parties, you know, and it was making people really sick, and the Indians, of course, hated it too.
Resentment within the division?
I don't think anybody suspected at the time that it was a deliberate sort of racist insult, but it leaked out later on. Yeah, and anyway, I picked up the battery just outside Benghazi. Where were we then? Yeah, dates are very elusive now at this point. I know it was raining one hell of a lot, and there was a lot of red earth and clay sticking to our boots, and it was a very miserable period. We spent Christmas in... that's it. It was. I got there before Christmas, because we spent Christmas in tents. We dug in, because we were... bombed 2 or 3 times, and then the position was strafed. But it was outside Benghazi, I'm sure it was. And Because the lads were talking about this lovely bit of Cyrenaica that they'd gone through. Everything was green, and all the Italian settlers were coming out and giving them eggs and doing the V sign. Where we were was hideous. And we spent Christmas Day. I borrowed a sergeant's tunic. We'd heard there was a mobile Nafi. I borrowed the sergeant's tunic. And I had a jeep. We'd got jeeps at that time. The jeeps. And although it was only a Lance Bombardier, I had this jeep and wireless set. And it was to do with the battery captain, that's right. And anyway, I took this jeep, and my friend Ernie Keel, who died later, and we drove quite a long way to this mobile Nafi. And because I was a sergeant, I was allowed a bottle of rum. And in fact, I got two bottles of rum. I said, for my other sergeant mate, I count them. And we got a lot of other goods as well, you know, cigarettes and so on. And we drove back, and that was Christmas Day. Yeah, it was. It was actually Christmas Day. And we sat in this teeming rain with a bivouac. They weren't real tents. They were bivouacs that buttoned down the middle and served as ground sheets when they were unbuttoned. And the rain was just pissing in through the... And the hole that we dug was full of mud. And we were just soaked. It was, you know, I sympathise with World War I people. It was like that sort of situation, with mud 4 inches deep sticking to your boots, you know. And which way? We just sat and in the rain and drank this rum. And we boiled water and we made hot tea, I think, yeah, tea, and put mustard, you know, half tea, half rum. We had a good Christmas, anyway. There were no special rations. There was nothing. It was pretty glum, really. We then went forward to... God knows. There's a lot of blanks here now. There's Serti, Barchi. I remember going into this town, Serti, and it was... People were all for sort of leaping out and... And having us, you know, we were going to camp outside, to Lago, as we called it, outside of Serti. And people wanted to go and explore the town. And then we saw these notices everywhere that the whole of Serti was booby-trapped. Yeah, things like, Serti is dirty and full of booby-traps. That was one big notice. Yeah. So we didn't see anything of that town. We didn't see anything of Benghazi. And then we stopped for quite a long time. We were training. We had to... All the signals had to be reclassified.
What did that involve?
It meant you were classified as a signal, but you had to sort of reset your tests, you know, particularly the Morse reading tests, wireless procedure tests. God, I can't remember now, but...
Did you have any problems?
But no, because I was quite proud of my efficiency, and yes, I got my stripe back, by the way. I didn't mention that, did I?
You hadn't, no.
I had that torn off me and sent to prison in India, yeah, but I got it back.
When did you get it back?
Oh, sometime in August, I think.
During the quiet, relatively quiet period.
No, September was the quieter period. I got it back in August, I think, yeah.